in 1973, Uncle George picked up his first comic book from the spinning rack at the corner convenience store in his neighborhood. In 1993, Epic Boss McFall walked into his first comic shop and bought his first graphic novel. In the early 2010s, both men were imprisoned in the New 52, a maximum security universe neither of them asked for. Somewhere around 2015, they escaped. And now we're a podcast comparing the old school with the new guard. If you can find them, which is really easy, you might listen to Panel by Panel.
Welcome to Panel by Panel, where we dig into the back bins of the digital comics to find the gems and to refresh the stories that you may have forgotten about. I am Epic Boss McFall, and along with us is Uncle George, who experienced a lot of these storylines firsthand as I'm reading them secondhand. But today's different. Today, I actually experienced the Runaways firsthand when it came out, and was one of the few, apparently, in our crew of Marvel historians that we have at the Helicarrier Network who actually did experience it as it came out. And that's the story we're going to tackle today. And this is the first time you've actually read it, right?
This is, yeah. The way it worked out was that I'd kind of seen the ads and the covers in the stores, but never picked one up. And my daughter, Madeline, asked me to get her the collections for her. So I thought, okay. Well, in moving around the town as she has, I've got a lot of her stuff, including her comics and her trade paperbacks. So I dug them out once we saw some of these characters show up in Marvel's Avengers Alliance, and decided I'd read the trade paperbacks that she has. So that's what we picked out for this show.
Yep, and I was excited because it gave me a reason to go back again, and I loved it. Now, I got to say, you see a title like Runaways, and I think the very first cover showed two or three of the kids together. So it just felt like a teeny bopper kind of comic. However, it was written by, I think, Brian K. Vaughan.
That's correct.
Yep, Brian K. Vaughan, which is one of my favorite modern authors of Marvel. Just really, really, his work resonates with me. I think he's done some work on the X-Men. He's done some. Actually, you know what? I can click his name right here, and I can tell you what he's worked on. If I see his name on it now, I'm really into it. Here's his career. Tales of the Age of Apocalypse in 96 was his first credit, it sounds like. He's worked on X-Men, Spider-Man, Captain America. Also some Batman and Green Lantern for DC Comics. And, of course, who wouldn't be proud of their work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer for Dark Horse Comics? Yes.
This His is crowning achievement was?
Why the Last Man.
Yes.
Yeah, that was amazing. I did forget that. That's where I really picked him up first.
That's right. I became a fan of his.
Yeah. There was some other movie being made, and I hadn't heard of it. I can't remember what it was, but some obscure comic book movie. I'm like, all right, I'll see if I go find it. And I got confused at what the movie was. And I thought it was Why the Last Man. So I started reading that. And that's how I picked up that book to start with. And that's neither here nor there because it's not Marvel. But it's a great series. Go to your local library. Go find it at Barnes & Noble's. Whatever you need to do. But it's a – what do they call a one-run series? I mean, it did 11 episodes, more or less, 11 issues, but it was a start to finish done story. It wasn't an ongoing thing.
You're talking about Why?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was around about 60 to 70 issues, something like that.
60, okay.
So it was a limited series, but in like the broadest sense.
Gotcha. And it's published by Vertigo. And the reason my number was off, it's in 10 paperback volumes, which is how I read it.
Right.
So that's why I was thinking 10 or 11. But yeah, okay. Everybody go check that out. So Brian K. Vaughan did The Runaways. I'm like, all right, it's Brian. I'll try it. and I liked it. You just read it for the first time. Why don't you tell me your experience with it? Give me the overview story as you see it.
Okay. Well, to give everybody the background to either to refresh or for those who aren't familiar, the story revolves around six teenagers who discover that their parents are supervillains who are in normal life important individuals around the Los Angeles area. So they witness them committing a murder unbeknown to the parents, and then they take off on their own and decide to make amends and strike back at their parents.
Yes. As I reread it the second time, or maybe the third time, I can't remember how many times I've read through it, but as I read it again, I'm a little astounded by some of the things I bought into the first time that still hold up, but I didn't question. Like, it wasn't just a murder. It's very ritualistic, very
correct,
very crazy-esque. And then when they ran away, they just instantly ran away. You know, oh, we're gone now. You know,
yeah,
instead of the
yeah.
torment that you would expect from a storyline nowadays. And this is written in 2003, was the first. And it's been 10 years, a little over 10 years since it first came out. And I think we've just grown so much as a reading collective that we would expect more out of the characters. Yeah, especially
right.
like since Civil War. We expect more inner turmoil and struggle and those darkness and those kind of things. So I was surprised by that. But once you get past it, you think about how you might react as a teenager who discovered you had some kind of powers or backstory, mm-hmm. and they became their own little superhero group for a little bit.
Yeah, and you touched on one of my main issues. I have about half a dozen things that I wasn't completely pleased with on that, and that's one of them, that it seemed like they were really quick to believe the worst about their parents and just run away and team up and decide that they're going to team up to fight them. It's, you know, reading it month to month, I can see where you'd have a lot of time and that would be disguised by the amount of time that passes between issues for yeah. the reader. But then when you read it in one sitting, it's very sudden.
Yes. Yeah. There were some very hard shifts in the storyline. So we can jump to the middle. They're in their hideout. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. stop a robbery at a convenience store because they were trying to get some food with what little. A lot of it made sense. You know, we got to stay off the grid. We don't want our parents to find us. We're not going to use our ATM cards. We have a little bit of cash. So they go to the convenience store and it's being robbed.
Mm-hmm.
And as any kid does who discovered they have powers, I guess, they go and try to stop the robbery and end up somewhat adopting this kid who was involved in the robbery because his parents were evil. Mm-hmm. And that shifts really quickly to he was a vampire, you know? And I mean, it was just a really quick, I'm not sure where they were trying to go with that. Is you have this whole, our parents are trying to kill us story that I'm enthralled in, you know, I'm caught up.
Yeah.
In. And then this vampire gets introduced and then he dies. You're very quickly because
yes.
he bit Lucy in the Sky, as her nickname is.
Mm-hmm.
And her powers are based. She's an alien and her powers are all color light based. And they're like the sun. So, of course, when he bit her, he got sunburned internally and exploded.
Which was a fun moment.
It was.
Although I did take issue with him saying that stakes don't work on vampires. That's only in the Joss Whedon version.
Yeah,
some comment
wrong.
Like,
yeah.
But you know, being a big fan of all the Supernatural series from Marvel, no, it's been established that vampires in the Marvel universe are killed by stakes, among other things. So, I'm going, come on, Brian, stick with the Marvel universe.
Yeah, that was a little odd, but I wish I can see a lot of ways around that. Okay, so what we're referring to is Nika Minoru. Her power of one staff, she discovers she's basically a sorceress.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents dabble, as they said 20 years prior to the beginning of the story, they dabble in the dark arts, which means they're super powerful now, and they have the staff of one. And if you've played Marvel Avengers Alliance, you're familiar with how that works. When the parents discover that the kids have found out who they are, and the kids are, like any teenagers, they're lashing out, they're fighting, they're doing things, the parents, who are quite evil. I thought the parents were consistent throughout the whole story. They're evil. I mean, they're trying to end the human race for these big giants. And, you know, so they respond very quickly with extreme violence. And so she absorbs the staff of one, which they did not see coming. And So jump forward to this little sidebar with the vampire. She brings forth the Staff of One. It goes right through him. And that's where he said, you know, Whedon got it wrong. Stakes don't harm us. I'm like, there could have been a couple ways around that. Because it's not really a stake. It's a staff it's mystical staff. We're not really sure what it's made of. So we're kind of left, like you're saying, we're kind of left holding the bat going, did he break from the Marvel canon or what happened there? And they never really resolved that.
Well, in my head, I resolved it by thinking, okay, he was lying to her in order True. To make her think that he can't be killed that way. So, you know, that's, like I said, it's a minor nitpick.
Sure. And fire did not faze him either.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. But, of course, the sunlight inside is good. Power Princess. Princess Powerful. That's her name.
Princess Mala. Powerful.
God,
yeah.
Man, she is such a fun character. Because he did not make her bratty. I think he was trying to make her bratty, being mm-hmm. an 11-year-old, and she threw some temper tantrums and this and that and the other. And I know, I believe, in the when they bring the series back in 2005 and then again in 2008 or 9, I don't remember exact dates, that I think she does become a little bit more bratty. But she's a mutant, and she's super powerful. She's so powerful, she rips the cloak off of Cloak, the Cloak and Dagger. Which is supposed to be impossible. Love the line. Not even God could separate it. Rip.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, being a Cloak and Dagger fan from way back, that was a kind of a wow moment.
You know, that's my first real interaction with them. I knew of them, but I don't still really know much about them. So I liked the interaction here in the Runaways, how it introduced me to a team that they refer to as the B-list of Avengers.
yeah.
But they did well with explaining it for people like me who had no experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the vampire thing. That went on. That was a crazy little side moment. But it was impetus for nothing, really.
Yeah. It comes with the difference in time between reading it month by month and then reading it in a trade paperback, where things build slowly as you're reading month by month and right. It kind of makes more sense. But then when it's assembled in one shot, then things happen suddenly and then they end suddenly. So yeah, that's something that didn't quite sit right with me. But
we expect more now, but at the time it just flowed. And like you said, it does get erased with the month by month and the spacing between it. Okay, back to the main story. Their parents, they sneak out. The parents are part of the Pride, which is the it's not even satanic, really, but it is this mystical cabal that runs the West Coast.
Right.
And it's this set of six parents, so 12 people. So there are six kids now in the Runaways. And I like the little subtle references they make. They talk about Whedon and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They reference Power Pack when they were robbing the store. And the kids were like, who's Power Pack?
Yeah, that was a funny moment.
Yeah, they reference a bunch of little things there. Cloak and Dagger reference a few things. So the parents discover they're gone because the cops basically tell them that they're gone. And it's well established that they rule the world. They have agents everywhere. You can't get away from them, so on and so forth. Never really quite explains what each of them do to rule the world or why. It does dabble into why they're so powerful, but I think at some point Marvel said, okay, you've got 6 months and we're shutting it down. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think he started going, okay, I got to wrap up the ends here and finish this story arc. You find out certain powers can't be used against same people. My favorite is Gertrude, who gets the Velociraptor, the psychic Velociraptor. Now, her parents were the most interesting, I thought. What did you think about the time travelers? Because they never dove into them.
Yeah, it was, you barely even knew that they were time travelers from the context of the story. And then toward the end of it, you have a flashback to when they are first inducted by the the Gibberim.
Gibberim, there it is.
And you go, oh, so they've been traveling back and forth to different eras, but they got stuck in this one. Okay, now I get that. And yeah, the like you said, the parents' powers aren't explained very well. I got a little confused as to which parents were which couples were parents to which kid, and what powers they had or what their background was. So it was nice to finally have that clarification toward the end of the story.
Yeah, especially when they put on their costumes, you start really losing track of who's
exactly
who and what exactly they do. And I think that was part of Brian K. Vaughan's way of making us feel like the teenager, because the teens discovered it. We're, as reading it, we're discovering it with them. We don't know what's going on. The teens don't know what's going on. So I'll give them a little bit of credit there that I think it was an experiential lack of information versus just not good writing.
Yeah, that's a valid perspective.
Because the first time we find out about her parents is when she finds the dinosaur by accident, and the holograph comes up and say, we traveled to the 30th something century before our machine, before whatever it was, broke. We traveled to the 30th something century and had her commissioned for you. And she's called Arsenic, which I thought was, I mean, Old Lace. I'm sorry, the dinosaur is Old Lace, which I thought immediately was amazing. I loved that movie reference and how they even mock it a little bit in the story of the kids are like, What are you talking about, Arsenic and Old Lace? Like, first, watch a movie before 1985. And secondly, yeah. So she's my favorite character because of the dinosaur. I thought that'd be the coolest power to have. It's just a psychic connection with the raptor. You know, I'm sorry. It's just, I don't know. So then you've got Chase, the blonde California kid whose parents are tech geeks. But again, we don't know what they do or how they influence the world and what power they have.
Right. It seemed like their sole purpose was providing providing Chase to the story, and the fistigons, mechanical hands that he uses, and his X-ray goggles.
Yeah,
and beyond that, their contribution was nothing.
Yeah. And it was a very Hollywood plot moment when they're discovered, and they're like, if he learns how to weaponize those are the most powerful gauntlets ever made. It's like, oh, really? You know, he picks up the one thing in this entire workshop that's the most powerful thing in there. And, you know, that
exactly.
It plays well later, kind of. But yeah, it was like, what are you doing? You're killing me.
Yeah.
So that was Chase. And then you have, I forget her real name, but Lucy in the Sky, Carolina, who's an alien, which I kind of thought on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they might have been going down that road with Sky, but apparently not. If you've seen the season finale of season two, I don't recognize who she's supposedly turned into, but Ibbot Klotz seemed to have some kind of idea of what Sky has turned. I wouldn't say mutated into, because I don't know that she's a mutant, but changed into. But yeah,
I've got a bit of catching up to do before I get there.
Yeah. So it won't ruin it. You know, I'll let you get there. But you know, it was definitely an inevitable arc down that storyline of, you know, she's different. I mean, they've been playing that up huge in the first season and even more so in the second season. And so at the end of the second season, it kind of comes to a head, and I'll just leave it there. But I did think that they were taking – I thought that she was going to be Carolina, and that's not the case. So that's – see, Nico Minoru, who's the sorceress, and you've got Carolina, who's an alien, and her powers are like sunlight. You have Molly Hayes, who is a mutant and super freaking strong, apparently, even more so than the Hulk. Which I'm very much looking forward to the newer issues to see where they go with that. Chase, whose parents were tech, and his big thing seems to be hiding from the man, you know, conspiracy theorist kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which isn't really a power. Alex, who was the sons of the gangsters, essentially. They were the kingpins.
Right.
Which they didn't have power either. Not true power. They had earthly power, you know, wealth, thuggery, whatever.
Yeah, they're pretty much just a pair of brush criminals.
Yeah. I think that's it. And Gert had the time-traveling parents. think that's pretty much everybody. So they get discovered. Now, I think this whole story lasted, what, 24 hours, basically?
You know, that's another thing that comes from reading it all in one stretch. The first part seemed to be taking place in, like, the first 10 issues or so seemed to be taking place within 24 hours. But then there are references in the last few issues of it being, like, a year. And I don't know if I misread that, but
the very last issue, there's a significant amount of time,
mm-hmm.
Because of how everything went down. It's really hard to say.
Yeah.
Because there's two, all we know for sure is there's two ceremonies. And we do know that there were at least a couple of days passed between them. There was a ceremony of blood, which is where they discovered, because the parents murdered a young girl.
Right.
And that's where they discovered everything. They ran away that night. Different things happened. We're not really clear. At one point, they did say something about 4 days. Gert was talking about how she hadn't slept in 4 days.
Uh-huh.
And I know at one point, while the parents were looking for him, there's a reference of a couple of days had passed. But it really had the feel of less than a week. Obviously, it had the feel of 24 hours, which now that we really pull the details out, it's not that quick. So, yeah, we don't know. Then there's the ceremony of thunder, which was kind of just a nice catalyst to end the story.
Yeah.
So tell me what you thought about the cops raided them. Let's go from where the cops raided the hideout and to the ceremony of thunder. Tell me your impressions on that.
Okay. Let's see. The cops found them in their hideout. It just struck me as, okay, so that's the plot point they're going with, but how did the cops find them? Well, that's explained later.
Yeah.
So that worked out for me. And then they have to escape. They are successful in making their escape. No major spoiler there. And then, along the way, they have found out what the parents are planning. So they have the means to go to the lair of the Gibberim, which is way, way down beneath the surface of the Pacific Ocean. And then that's where the climax of this 18-issue arc takes place, where the children confront the parents. A secret alliance is revealed, and...
which was weak sauce. It did nothing. It ended up having no point to it.
And it turned out to be pretty much who I predicted.
That's what I love about the different set of eyes that we have is mm-hmm. I never thought twice about the parents. I was just there with the kids, living mm-hmm. in the moment, reacting mm-hmm. to everything they were reacting with. And you read it with, okay, this is going to happen and that's going to happen and we're going to see this turn around, and then you were right about that.
Yeah, I had my suspicions, and it turned out the way that the story unfolded, I was right about those. Overall, it worked for me. It wasn't the awesome story I was hoping to see from Brian K. Vaughan. The plot line was decent. I did have a trouble with the same thing that I have a lot of trouble with many authors trying to write kids that are younger than themselves, in that they don't sound like kids I hear in real life. They sound like a grown-up trying to write a kid as he thinks they sound, if that makes sense. So I was a little disappointed in the quality of Vaughn's dialogue in this. But overall, I found it to be an enjoyable series.
I liked it. Now, the one thing we haven't touched on, and we kind of glanced over, was the Gibberim. Mm-hmm. This was another odd twist to me. I thought was kind of cool, but out of left field, besides the vampire.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Was left field.
Yeah.
Cloak and Dagger was great. Made sense to bring them in. It explained who they were. I loved the interactions there. It was cool interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get down to this, the thing of thunder, the Sacrifice of Thunder, whatever they called it. And it's somehow in this underwater lair that somehow the kids discovered. You know, they've stolen the books. Okay, there's this big book of how to behave as an evil genius or whatever it is, and they got the Dakota ring, and Alex, the thug kid, who apparently is very smart in strategy, is decoding this, and they're reading, and apparently the Gibberum are ancient giants with six toes that
and six fingers and on six each hand
on each hand that predate the Old Testament.
Uh-huh.
And somehow they summoned these all these sets of parents. Well, they weren't parents at the time, but these sets of adults, and explained that they wanted to end the world because they lived in a time of euphoria and peace and utopia, those kind of things. I meant to say utopia, not euphoria.
But, right.
they did drugs. I don't know. So it was kind of like this, okay, they summoned all these people from these moments in their lives, and they were two mutants, which they were the two tech people, the time travelers, the sorcery. Didn't really explain why they picked these people or why they need their help, but they want to erase humankind from the planet so they, as these giants, could restore the Earth back to utopia.
Exactly.
And they get 25 years to rule the world, the humans, the parents do, and then six people get to come with them into utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's incentive, because there's 12 physical people there, all these couples. There's six couples. And they, at some point, that's where it was explained that they were time travelers. They explained some of the powers and who could do what. And then they were magnifying, these giants were magnifying their powers. And I'm thinking, so you have enough power to magnify the powers of these people, make them all powerful, to let them rule the world so that they sacrifice stuff to you, but you don't have enough power to come out from underwater.
Yeah.
It's a little odd. And
yeah, there are many things in the whole storyline that seem arbitrary like that.
Yeah. And so then it's very anticlimactic, right? The kids get down there. I never quite figured out how they figured out where this thing was. But they get down there, and they get attacked by this giant rock beast, and they turn off the sentry, and they go to attack the parents, and they have this plan. They're fighting. And then now the whole time, right, the whole time, you've been seeing that there's some kind of mole in the group.
Yes.
And that's been coming out. And that's how it was explained, how the cops found the lair, so on and so forth. And it turns out Alex is the mole because he was always faithful to his parents. He'd been
spoiler alert.
Sorry. You're right. If you haven't read it from 2003, I did just spoil it a little bit for you. Yeah. Sorry.
So that's okay.
I'll put a warning in the show notes. You're right. We should avoid spoiler alerts because we haven't read some of this stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, this was all new to me.
Yeah, so I do apologize. Uncle George is correct. So it turns out that somebody was the mole, and there was this fight. It doesn't explain how the mole can control the staff of one. Right. I guess it's just a magical staff. Whoever has it can use it. There's a little flaky on how some of that worked. But then,
well, he did have the book that detailed the Pride's history, and he had been deciphering it for about a year. So I can see where he would have learned how to use the Staff of One to the best of his ability, where he could find the underwater layer, and et cetera.
Okay. Yeah, you know what? You got a point there. So then all of a sudden the Gibberum show up because Molly – until they said something, I didn't even realize it's what she had in her hands. But I don't even know what the sacrifice of thunder is. It's some kind of energetic power that Molly just got pissed off and broke.
Well, it's where they provide the Gibberim with the soul of their sacrificed victims.
Oh, it was the soul.
Yeah. So it was contained in some kind of device. When Molly destroyed it, then the soul was released and the ceremony could not be completed.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I never quite, somehow, I guess because I was speed reading to brush up on it to catch up with you, I didn't quite catch that detail in the second run around. So I even went back a few panels and went, okay, what was that she did? What did she have?
Right.
I don't know. And as soon as she did that, right, that's when the Gibberum show up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, basically, screw you guys. You're not going to feed us. We're going to use the rest of our power to crush you. And now here's the real spoiler, because I have to talk about how this ended anticlimactically. Then all of a sudden, one of the characters they left behind busts through a window with the car that the parents had left behind. Well, the underwater vehicle, whatever you call it, the frog. I forget what they called it.
The Frogger.
The Frogger, which is a cool little machine. He busts through. Everybody comes on board, except for the people who are already dead. And get out of there super fast. And when they do, all the water crushes in and kills everybody.
Assumedly.
Well, yeah, presumably. And if the water didn't do it, the Gibberum are killing them, right? You know, presumably.
Right, right.
And then they pull up the shore and Captain America is there. Just, hey.
Just out of the blue.
Just out of the blue. I remembered somehow they had decoded, they figured out something was wrong with Cloak and Dagger because the parents did erase their memory so that Cloak and Dagger couldn't go back and tell anybody.
Right.
I assumed that that's what it was, but when I read back through it, it didn't really dive into that.
Yeah, I'm not sure unless, you know, one of the things I've learned from reading superhero comics is I got to fill in a lot of the gaps in my own head. So the way I explained that is whoever was on watch duty at the Avengers saw this event go on off the coast of California. So they sent out a team with the Quinjet and investigated what was going on.
You know what? I'll take that. That'll work. And then the very last issue fills in nothing, right?
Other than the kids.
The Avengers put the kids in homes, in foster homes, and took the dinosaur and took all the toys and everything away. And then the kids, of course, run away. And the very last panel is them getting in the Frogger and flying off into the second star to the right.
The last issue served a dual purpose. It was to wrap up all the loose ends and to set up the sequel.
Yeah. And there wasn't a whole lot of loose ends. I mean, really, it really didn't.
Right, right.
I didn't think it filled in any of the gaps. And it brought the team back together.
Mm-hmm.
And it did leave a mystery. It did leave one mystery at the very end about Nico, right? Because they toss her a knife. Because the whole sacrifice of blood. They toss her a knife, and she refuses to cut herself and ends up stabbing a robot instead, which was actually a pretty cool scene.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't explain why. She literally says, because Chase throws her a knife, she catches it, she pops it, and she goes, "I can't."
Right. What's going on there? We don't know.
And then she, like I said, she stabs the robot in the eye and it falls down dead. So, overall,
pretty powerful pocket knife.
And it Brian K. Vaughan does leave a little bit to the fun imagination there, because even the character Chase goes, "Wow, that's like the third coolest thing I've ever seen."
Yeah.
Just kind of like, yeah, that was fun. I'm just going to do it because I have to stop writing this book now. Overall, I still think it's a great, I don't know, I just really love the experience of it. But you thought it was ho-hum.
I thought it was okay. If I graded it, I would give it a B-, C-plus, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay.
Let's see. The art was done by Adrian Alfona, and I wasn't really blown away by his art. I thought it was a little too sketchy for my tastes. Like I said, entertaining read, but not really blown away by it.
Now, as it turns out, because that was the main chunk of what I had read. I've read a little bit of the other stuff, the 2005 series, the sequel, which actually cracks me up as it starts off, because in the first five pages, they make two jokes about Wonder Man, about how he doesn't count as a hero. It cracks me up. So then there's the Runaways from 2005-2008, and again 2008-2009, and then Pride and Joy and The Good Die Young are both going on currently from 2009 to now. So I'm looking forward to really digging into those. That might be something we tackle here. Who knows? We've got some more stuff coming up. Uncle George, you got anything else to say about the Runaways?
Yeah, I think I had a bit of prejudice going into this, because when I first heard the concept, which was Kids of Supervillains. I thought, great, who are the supervillains going to be? So I'm thinking, you know, are they picking up all these established characters? And then it turns out to be these fairly nondescript new characters that were made up for the series. And I was, oh, that's kind of disappointing. Because, you know, say it would have been like Radioactive Man and Volcana. They got together and they had a kid and, you know, he's part of the Runaways. That would have been a fun concept in my view, but
yeah,
but no less valid than this. I do have to say that, you know, I'm kind of an old fart fan. A lot of the stuff that I like is from earlier in Marvel's history. So I have to admit that this series wasn't really aimed at me or my type of reader, because it's aimed more at the younger reader like my daughter, who just absolutely loves it. So, you know, kudos to it for that.
Yeah, I don't know how to take that. It's like, I loved it. I'm a little girl. I fully, yeah, I just thought the only other storyline we've covered so far was the Dark Phoenix, which is from the late 70s, early 80s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and that you're dead on. So yeah, definitely, I think it's going to make for a lot of interesting discussions as we tackle the stories. Now, there is a new story we're tackling soon. It was much larger than either one of us anticipated, but we're tackling our first major multi-book crossover event, The War of Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And that, man, I'm so glad you suggested that. That is so epic. And I can't wait till we can bring that to the show. But
yes, looking forward to it.
Until we get that read. You can find me on facebook.com/House of the Bear. You can find the show at thehelicarrier.com. And you can find George here on the show. And sometimes you will appear also on our other show, the flagship show of the Helicarrier Network, from the Helicarrier.
When I get permission to come aboard.
And that's not me. That would be Agent Emmett, who issues permissions. You're always welcome. And I know he has you welcome as well. So until then, you can email us. Right now we'll go, you know what? We'll figure out the contact information. We're still getting everything put together. But we hope you tune in and read more and go panel by panel and let us know what you think.